Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Very happy to be joined today by my friend and colleague, Zach Elkins. Zach is a professor in UT's government department, where he's taught since 2008. He's the co-author of several books and articles related to constitution making and constitutional longevity, among other things, really. And with Tom Ginsburg, he directs both the Comparative Constitutions Project, an NSF-funded initiative to understand the causes and consequences of constitutional choice. I don't know how current that NSF thing is, certainly it's not untrue, at least at one point in time, right? And the spinoff web project Constitute, which provides resources and analysis for constitutional drafters in new democracies. And if you're seeing this on a podcast platform, we'll put some of these links to the extent we can fit it in the summary. You'll also find fuller links to Zach's work and particularly these really valuable websites that he works on our website in the usual blog post space where we put players for the podcast. And that's, of course, at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. So, Zach, welcome. It's really, we talked about this for a while. It's really great to have you back in the studio.
Jim, real pleasure to be here anytime. And one thing I wanted to add is hot off the press, and you might not even know this, but we just started a center on law and democracy here, launched it 2 weeks ago, and it really, for those in the Austin area, it's really going to be a valuable resource. We've been, I think, this university has been the home for, anything law and democracy for a long time, and this finally, institutionalizes that.
I got the notice on that, and I was going to put it in the notes at some point, so I'm glad you raised it. And I'm actually, since we're starting, tell us a little bit about what you guys are doing.
Yeah. Okay. So we started this working group about, 12 or 13 years ago called the Working Group on Law and Democracy. And the whole idea was we had a lot of people in the law school and the political science department, the government department, working on these issues. And we would meet over lunch, really delicious lunch, to think about these ideas. And it was just, an incredible group of people. And, as things evolved, that was it. I mean, I think for academics, the ideal thing is to disappear for 3 hours and then show up for a really good lunch for only an hour or two with people you really like. And so that's the whole premise. But we'll have events. We have an internship program where you send people down to Latin America and to Eurasia to work on law and democracy in various ways. And we've got we're home for the minor in law, justice, and society. Just trying to keep things interesting.
I like that. As you know, I'm a big fan of building these things and then figuring out ways to put them together so that you can, it's a way of actually getting more value for yourself, for your time, but also for what the university is generating. When you figure out where those things are, you kind of get them going and then you get them feeding each other.
Yeah, I think you and I share that. It's fun to build things.
It is. It is. And, and to do so in ways that, to be fair, it serves us. We're getting to, we have great jobs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And we get to do a lot of interesting things. But then I've really, talking about all the things that you've done about this new project or this next stage of this project, it's great to be able to kind of spin those things out in a kind of public facing way that people can engage in.
Yeah. It may mean 20 or 30 more emails per day, but, what's that?
Right. I always say my inbox looks like the first 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan anyway.
I love that. It's
chaos and severed limbs and disaster and luck and the drama of chaos. So, it's funny. We were talking before we went online. Last time we kind of talked for the record that I remember was for some Constitution Day videos that we recorded back in 2006 and 2007. And I was looking back at those, and they're on our YouTube channel, or the excerpts are. And I think they're even still somewhere on the UT website, buried beneath a few layers of stuff.
That's good, because I'm trying to keep my profile picture from 2007, 2008. Yeah, no, and so this is fitting with that theme. That's good.
I think you've aged very well, but you look about 12.
I love that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a very youthful aspect.
I feel about 12, so that's good. Yeah.
So, you know, where to start? Like I said, I got the idea of inviting you to chat because I've been thinking a lot about separation of powers, checks and balances, the operation of the Constitution, you know, kind of at the intersection of what's going on in the world, but also being dropped back into the challenges of teaching an intro to American politics class that involves talking about basic constitutional principles and in this environment. And, you know, the crux of, as we were talking about, again, talking before, the crux of some of your early work in particular was that, like, how to sort out, institutional design and the internal factors of the constitutional order versus the effects of the external environment, right? And, you know, a lot going on in that, in that area right now. So let me just start with this question. You know, do you see, as you're watching politics, and I know you watch things closely, a significant shift in the operation of structure, of separation of powers and checks and balances right now? You know, start maybe in the context of the general sense that Congress has had a habit for a long time of a degree of deference to the executive in the American system. You know, I don't think that's very controversial. But I'm just wondering sort of how do you, as you look at this from this framework, what are you seeing in terms of shifts in those, in the function of those principles, their effects on the questions that you're interested in? It's a pretty open-ended question, but, you know, am I wrong to think that this is really kind of raising some fundamental questions in that area that I think we haven't asked in a fundamental way in a long time because we hasn't seemed like worth asking?
Yeah. No, I think there has been a sizable shift, and I think it reminds us that the personalities involved really matter, not just the structure of the Constitution and the norms. And in some ways, like I think back to, you know, the early presidents and we're going way back, of course, but, you know, George Washington, you know, most of his vetoes were about preserving the Constitution. He was vetoing things, not that he didn't like, but things that he thought actually crossed the limits of the Constitution. So there was a real sense that presidents would not just abide by the Constitution, but protect it. And, you know, of course, this was before judicial review really became a thing, which, of course, you know, as you tell your 3-10 suits, is not in the Constitution.
Right.
So, I mean, the thought was that both legislators and presidents, I think, would protect the Constitution. And, you know, it's the same Constitution, of course, that we're operating under. And one of the great, you know, research opportunities is to see, you know, how things work when you have different personnel in the presidency, a different arrangement of parties in Congress, and also in the Supreme Court, and how these things come together. And I think we're, you know, it's the perfect storm right now because we have, you know, a president who has a few grievances, I'll say, and has had a term in which he's learned, you know, what he wants to do. And has a Congress that's in his favor and a pretty deferent. And then, of course, the Supreme Court, who's working with him. So I think, you know, things have changed. I want to talk about the contract a little bit and the Constitution and how that relates right now. But
yeah, do that. Well, okay. Let's talk about that.
Well,
I think that's probably important groundwork in terms of how you think about these things.
So yeah, I mean, one analog that I think about is if I were hiring somebody to do some work on my house or do anything, you know, we might put together a contract. Especially if somebody's building your house, you might put together a contract because you know you do want to hold that person to certain things. And you know, one thing you realize once you hire somebody is that, okay, they're going to have a lot of discretion. If you hire somebody to build your house, you're essentially letting them loose. And if you try to, you know, negotiate really hard in the contract, in the end, they'll actually take something out on you on the side. So like, whatever you negotiate, you know, you're giving them a lot of deference and a lot of a lot of trust. And you have to realize, okay, this is built on trust no matter what we actually write down in the contract. And I think the Constitution is one of those things too. I mean, we've got limits, obviously, very few, I would say, compared to modern constitutions, which constitutionalize pretty much every aspect of society.
Yeah, like Texas.
Like Texas, for example. Yeah. Yeah. And growing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. And I know, and you know, with the whatever 17 amendments that are up for election in next week or so, even longer pretty soon. I think the contract, as it's, you know, it's stripped down general framework contract that it is. I think we're seeing that that doesn't work. Sometimes when you hire somebody to do some work on your house, you know, you do want something a little more detailed and you want to specify some of the provisions.
Yeah.
We can go into all the various areas, whether it be international conflict or use of force here or the budget or tariffs, et cetera. And I think each one of those is kind of interesting to talk through. But
yeah, you know. I mean, well, there's an interesting, you know, just not to jump ahead, but in terms of the politics of this, you know, what they call in debate spreading the argument is clearly kind of what's going on here to some degree. Right,
yeah.
In the sense of, I'll just open as many fronts and test as many errors as we can.
Like yeah.
The politics of that are maybe a little more complicated than some people think. But, you know, I want to go back, though, because I want to key on something you said that does open this up. Because you, as you were giving that sort of overview, you mentioned in passing, like, the idea of structure and norms. Mm-hmm. And the where you ended that is kind of something I've been talking a lot about, our colleague Josh Blank, I spend a lot of time with regularly on the podcast. I mean, he's beginning to kind of wince a little because I keep bringing up norms. But it does, you know. Yes. But it seems to me that I hear a lot that I have been thinking about a lot and agree with in your sense that, you know, that was kind of a strikingly direct way of saying, well, this doesn't seem to be working, which is a little more direct than I expected from you to some degree.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do want to unpack that a little bit because it does seem like we're having to pay a lot more attention to norms now than academically and maybe even culturally in terms of norms of governance and constitutional norm and the role of norms in constitutional enforcement than we have in a long time. I mean, I was listening to a podcast a few weeks ago. I think it was the Powers That Be, one of the podcasts. And I think it was Leanne Caldwell, one of the sort of writers for Puck, was saying in terms of covering the response to President Trump's deployment of National Guard, that she'd been talking to a lot of, probably misquoting, it might be somebody else, but anyway, I can fix it later. But she was talking to a lot of military people. And there was this sense that people were very uncomfortable with it, but there was this growing pattern in which people's initial response to some of these extensions of executive authority, to put it politely, by the White House, people's initial response was very much like, well, that's not legal. And then you dig into it a little more and it's, well, that's actually not that clear, and people have just respected norms prior to this. Does that sound right to you? It sounds like it does. Like I'm just sort of confirming.
Yeah.
But talk a little bit more about that and how you kind of work that into how you think about constitutions generally, but also in the moment. Because it seems to me we're running into that again and again, where people go, well, surely we'll stop this in the courts. Now, there's a couple of variables with the courts, but even with lower courts that might be amenable to responding negatively to some of these innovations by the executive, they're having trouble finding the legal groundwork in a lot of places.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And, you know, obviously the Constitution itself doesn't specify too many of these things.
Right.
And I think, I mean, if you think back to like how we think about compliance with any law, the Constitution or otherwise, you know, in the end, there's only so much we can do. I mean, just think about in ordinary laws, you know, we only have, you know, the police may or may not know the zillions of laws that have been written by, you know, the local, state, and federal legislatures over the last 200 years, but are somehow, you know, enforcing it. And so they, you know, just think about that task for ordinary citizens. And then with presidents, obviously, there are a whole lot of legislative constraints, but, you know, we there's only so much energy capacity that I think the legal community and the Supreme Court has to deal with compliance. And I think over the years, and this gets to norms a little bit, I think we've relied on presidents to recognize those limits. And I think we sort of depended on a self-enforcing constitution to the extent that, you know, we thought we had a constitution that had clear limits that people understood, number one, and respected, and that there was this dynamic in which the president, restrained him or herself, recognizing that if he or she crossed those lines, there would be mass uprising among elites and the citizenry who recognized, you know, this constitution, this prized possession, could not actually be trampled upon. And so there was some natural restraint in that sense. And I think, we have a president who doesn't have that restraint, and I think kind of actually enjoys pushing the limits and enjoys. I think sometimes he'll just throw something out there and say, you know, can we do this? I don't know. Let's just see. Yeah. And so, so there's no natural restraint. I think that's not the temperament, obviously, of this president to exercise that restraint. In fact, it's the opposite. And so I think because of that temperament, the normal things that used to work, such as norms and kind of this slow legal process and elites who would rise up in mass, you know, rejecting this idea, it's just not happening in the same way.
So how do you sort of, in thinking about how that's played out, I'm wondering how you sort out the mixture of institutional factors and, or even narrower than that, internal constitutional factors and, you know, other stuff.
Yeah.
Right? Because, you know, embedded in in that characterization was a lot of different things. You know, we could talk about partisanship. We could talk about, you know, what happens when expectations aren't, you know, rational. I'm just wondering how you kind of sort that out, given, again, you know, when we started the broad kind of way you phrased this in your earlier work between, you know, kind of design versus environment. Because it seems to me that sort of suggests a lot of interpenetration of those two dynamics.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. Well put. I mean, because the background to that is, okay, if we do have a situation of noncompliance of either norms or laws, you know, what do we do about it? And do we need to redesign aspects of the Constitution, which I think we probably do, anticipating some of these issues. So, you know, and I think the big thing is the administrative state and whether we're going to have independent agencies that have, in terms of selection and removal of people in power, whether it be the Federal Reserve or the Trade Commission or any of the independent agencies that do really important work that need insulation from normal low politics, which really get in the way. I mean, I think that's the one aspect of our Constitution that we need. And, Trump is kind of the embodiment of this unitary executive idea in which we don't have this independence. And he imagines, and this is theorized, obviously, as you know, by a lot of people who agree with him, that, he does have the power to fire at will. And is using it.
Yeah.
I'm
curious. You've also done some work, as I recall, on kind of the politics of the court, the Supreme Court, and I'm going to get to that. But I'm wondering. I was the next thing in my notes was the unitary executive, which I figured was going to happen once we got together. Mm-hmm. So, tell me a little bit. Help us understand a little bit about how we might think about the evolution of that notion that you described, that, you know, the small instances, the executive should be able to hire and fire whoever he wants in the executive branch. But there's a broader kind of sense of executive authority embedded in that, or there's both informing and implications of it, kind of circular in that sense, that does go back to debates at the founding. I mean, when I talked about this in 310, I had the AI graphic generator build me a cartoon of Hamilton on steroids, you know, which is kind of how it feels to me. So there's a general sense there, but my specific question, I guess, that I want to at least get to is, explain to us how this theory of unitary executive goes from what seems to me like a relatively fringe, fringe is maybe a little too mean, but you know, you can tell me if I'm being too mean or not, but a kind of marginal minority position to something that is, seems to be kind of ruling the day right now.
Yeah. I mean, I think of it as, and I don't know if I would characterize as fringe, although I think it is, only because baked into, you know, our myths and our mythology and our thinking about the way American government works is there are quite a few checks and balances. And one of those certainly we would be within the executive branch. And if you think about the founders, you know, they would love the idea that some of this would be insulated from, you know, from low politics and from partisanship, et cetera, and that there's so much expertise that goes into the administrative agencies that you need that expertise and that technocracy, and you need things that are a little more stable from administration to administration. You know, you need a judicial branch that can prosecute and investigate things that, you know, are just completely above politics. I mean, I think everybody would want that. You want a Federal Reserve that can manage the economy because of this dynamic inconsistency problem that we have in that president's obviously always want to, you know, push the button on the economy and get as much money in there and right. growth, et cetera, as possible. We understand that, you know, we need some self-restraint and we need some restraint on that. So it's just obvious in many of these administrative agencies that are so technical that they need to be insulated by politics. We need a meritocracy. And, you know, I think they recognize this. You know, in the beginning of the 1900s, with the progressive movement, and they realized, okay, we need a meritocratic way to bring people in and insulate them and keep them there, you know, from administration to administration. And I think there's so many people who worked in D.C. over the years for different administrations in these agencies. And, you know, this, you know, deep state, if you want to call it that, or bureaucracy. And I think they served us well because they were able to be above the fray and use their expertise, whether that's, you know, the EPA or any of the other agencies that are kind of, you know, on the chopping block.
Yeah. You know, I'm interested in how you, I mean, I kind of want you to push you to connect those two a little bit because, you know, I readily take, you know, the position that me characterizing the unitary theory, the unitary executive is kind of fringe, is shorthand. But I am curious, like, if you have a view of, you know, you kind of sketch out two intertwined paths there. One is, you know, kind of implicit that this unitary theory executive is always kind of percolating along in there. It's always kind of there. But it kind of took a back seat in the historical trajectory that you just kind of pieced together of, you know, the building of the administrative state, Skronik or whatever we want to, you know, that trajectory of history. I guess I'm asking you to suggest, so what happened, right? Yeah. That all of a sudden, I mean, you've suggested one piece, which is just Donald Trump's willing to impulsively challenge things and see how they go and not shy away from a fight necessarily. But it does seem to me that something that was more bubbling under became a much more dominant way of thinking about the political system and, you know, the relationship between the branches and the strength of the executive branch.
Yeah.
I mean, is it just court? I mean, you know, what, when you make, how do you make sense of that?
Well, I think there is some tension in this. I mean, you know, because I think the unitary executive theory for a lot of people on its face, you know, makes a little bit of sense because they're like, okay, you know, we want people to get things done,
and,
you know,
boss.
And there's a lot of dysfunction in democracy, you know, because you have all these voices, and if you're having always trying to reach consensus on things, you know, it could be that you don't, you know, achieve anything. And I think there's something to that because, you know, since I don't know, at least in as you and I were growing up, it's not like Congress really was able to attack many of the major issues and challenges of our day in a really serious way, like whether that's healthcare, which is always a struggle, guns, another struggle, climate change, you know, prison reform, you name it. There are thousands of policy issues that challenge us, and it often seems that government can't respond to that very well. And we just think of that as one of the aspects of democracy that just, you know, that's how it, at least our democracy, that's how it is. So I think some people have always wanted a more muscular president who, if they have some ideas, whether it be about immigration in this case with President Trump, I mean, I think a lot of people have been frustrated, by the way, with immigration, both Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, ask Kamala Harris about that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that was a tragic misstep for her candidacy that, I mean, obviously they supported
comprehensive. I mean, there's a lot of other things going on there, but, you know,
the
weakened position of the Democratic candidate, whoever it was going to be, was certainly made weaker by the way that the border and the immigration issue played out, even though they had already pivoted by the time of the election, but
yeah,
too late.
Pivoted too late. I mean, they got on board with this comprehensive immigration reform, but of course the Republicans were not going to let them have credit for that. So it just didn't happen politically. But I think you're right. Early in the Biden administration, they could have been on top of that and just said, listen, you know, just like Barbara Jordan was when she was, you know, here in the 80s, she was like, listen, you know, we can be we have a fair, balanced immigration system, but we can also have one that, you know, defends the borders really well. And I think if Democrats and Biden had taken that stand, maybe they would have been a different position. I don't know. But the point is that these major issues that need comprehensive reform don't get major reform. And then getting back to your question about the unitary executive, I think people want something a little more muscular. And a Congress can do something other than just name post offices. And so that dysfunction, I think, is one reason why people think, okay, let's, you know.
And not to overly read too much into your examples, but it is interesting that, look, one could make the argument that, and we hear it a lot from political terms, but I think you could make it in a more even-handed way that, though we're seeing, it feels like we're crossing some kind of threshold right now. If you talk to people that are willing to, that are supportive of the current strengthening of the executive for the current political ends, they will point back and say, look, we didn't really start this. There were a lot of reliance on executive orders in the Obama administration, under the Biden administration. And this is, I would say not incredibly effective efforts to work on some of those longstanding policy problems you were talking about. And now we're continuing that, but it's now being continued in different policy directions, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
And
I think that's fair. Yeah. Yeah. And
so there's, I mean, it was interesting. I'm going, yeah, well, that makes sense, except that's not really what they're doing. Or at least in terms of what I think you have in mind, they're kind of moving the opposite direction.
Yeah.
I mean, using executive power, I mean, the response to climate change, the response to healthcare, the response to guns, I think is not exactly what you had in mind when you thought about them as intractable problems.
Right.
But we could point to this, you know, a lot of executive action in those areas right now.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, I think I think that's fair to say that, you know, every president has their agenda, and I think we've seen that. And this gets to your question of the evolution of this power. Like, I think people have seen that with presidents. They have their issues, and they've pushed them hard with both executive orders, signing statements that, you know, have allowed them to operate outside of Congress to some degree. Yeah. And I think presidents have used that, recognizing that they don't have much power legislatively. And this is something I've noticed just in looking at constitutions, over the last 20 years, is that, you know, if you actually look at the lawmaking power of the U.S. president, it's actually quite weak. They can't formally initiate legislation, although you could, you know, coax it into the stream. But and they do have veto power, but they can't dissolve Congress or otherwise really threaten Congress in any way, like other executives can in other countries, that have a lot of, in terms of the negotiating power, they've got more leverage over Congress to get things done and get things out of Congress. You know, they do have, you know, a lot of prime ministers, for example, in parliamentary systems have a really aggressive decree power that I think in that system, people realized, okay, the prime minister is going to be pretty weak. Let's give them decree power that allows them to enact legislation. And, you know, I guess the U.S. and the we've never really had any strong tradition of that in our presidency. But, you know, the executive order, I think, has become that. I mean, I don't think Trump has really done much in the legislature in terms of producing things, but he's produced a lot.
Yeah, this is not like an
executive order.
Johnson treatment kind of. I mean, he gives, I think, a version of the Johnson treatment, but it's not to coax the legislature to take a leadership role or to act.
Yeah.
Right? It's just browbeating people to do what he wants, I think, which is still effective for him.
Yeah.
And I also want to clean up something I said earlier, which is that, you know, if, and I know this again, teaching 310, because I built a chart on executive orders not too long ago.
Okay.
That, you know, I said that Biden and Obama did use them more, and they did, but the incidence in, particularly in the current term, is very high of using executive orders and signing statements in these more unilateral pieces.
Yeah.
But it didn't start with him. I mean, you could see it. And so,
right.
You know, I don't want to beat a dead horse. I kind of want to get your thoughts, though, on how much within normal parameter, constitutional parameters, those current dynamics are between the president and Congress. You know, and again, and you're not, I know you're not a Congress guy, but you thought about this in the more structural way. Because it does seem to me like we've crossed some kind of threshold. I hate to use the word tipping point because it's become so abused. But, you know, it was fair to be talking about this for the last probably 20, 30 years, if not longer, and talk of, we started congressional deference, you know, delegation, et cetera, et cetera. But has that, you know, should I be thinking about it that way?
Yeah.
I mean, does that make sense? You think that something is different that has thrown that out of whack?
Yeah.
Or, by out of whack, I should be more precise, that is a little bit outside of the normal parameters.
Yeah.
Or expected parameters.
I think it is, and it gets back to your point about norms and et cetera. And when I think about the various issues, I do feel like we're in a different area. So just take tariffs, for example, which obviously, you know, Trump's always loved tariffs, even going back to the, you know, 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
Like, I remember taking out ads against, you know, Japan, et cetera.
That's pretty well documented. He had a couple of, like, really key conversations with people while he was a developer about tariffs. And that just set in. You know, it happens to all of us. Sometimes you get ideas that latch on and, you know, we don't change them.
He's been sort of wearing the same outfit for the last 40 years and has a lot of the same ideas. When you really think about it, these are, I mean, we think of him as being kind of, I don't know, operating on a whim, but some of these things are kind of hardwired into him.
And then, right. That's an interesting way to put it. He's an interesting mixture of like tactical inconstancy, but a few very persistent preoccupations.
Yeah. So, I mean, on the tariff front, I mean, I do feel like, you know, that is something that Congress theoretically has power over. And of course, that's something that, you know, when Trump was elected, that was the one thing he was going to do, is operate as an economic nationalist and use that. And I thought he was going to use it, I think, a little more, I should say, skillfully than he has. Because exercising that as a cudgel and leverage on other governments, I thought he was going to get all sorts of things from them and all sorts of deals and carve out bilateral deals across countries and, you know, as he would put it, you know, put us on a winning path again. But I think it's more been just kind of just, I don't think it's had that effect, unfortunately, you know, for him. But I think his using the tariffs, which again is the congressional power, almost, and I know the Supreme Court is going to weigh in on this in a case coming up. Yeah. I can't imagine that they'll take away his tariff power, since it's just so intrinsic to who he is and what in his presidency and every aspect of it. But, you know, he's been exercising, not only using the tariff power, which he doesn't have, but exercising it in a really aggressive way, as we know. And so it's, you know, and this is where the, I guess, the whim comes in that it's like, Bolsonaro in Brazil, not a huge fan. Let's throw some tariffs down. Or, and same with his, you know, economic policy towards, I'm sure Colombia is going to get that treatment too, yeah, now that he's had that dust up with President Petro in Colombia, and then Milei in Argentina. He just kind of premised a whole bunch of economic aid, yeah, on his election. So it's kind of interesting.
They just increased again yesterday, I think. The amount of funds that they're going to release for Argentina went up by a bit again yesterday. Yeah.
It's a little weird and unprogrammatic and undisciplined, in the sense that I think, you know, people recognize, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, yeah, and he doesn't actually have that power, right, but he's exercising it in that way. So that,
but I get, but yeah, you know, but yeah, that's exactly what I want to get at, though, is, I mean, he doesn't, but clearly he does.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Way.
And so what, you know, how do we understand, I mean, look, there's an obvious, you know, I don't want to make something more complicated and institutional when we can just say, look, you know, if you look at structure of the party system, you look at partisanship, you look at polarization, you look at Trump's position, you see a fairly, you know, boxed in, if you want to be kind of more nasty about it, supine, Republican congressional leadership and members of Congress, yeah, that are just not going to push back on this. I mean, that's, yeah, why, I mean, when you said, you know, and Congress is not going to do anything, I was like, okay, why?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And, well, and I think the why is kind of fairly, yeah, clear. But then the question is, I mean, you talk, going back to your theme, your, you know, academic theme of longevity, is this going to, I mean, does this permanently alter the separation of powers? And I mean, because it seems to me, the question I keep asking is, you know, I'm not seeing a lot of checks here, and I'm seeing a rebalancing. And how permanent is that?
Yeah, that's really interesting, because, you know, the tit for tat that goes on in you know, Washington is such that, you know, and I think this is in the back of people's minds, like, okay, if we unleash this for this president, you know, who's to say that the next president of a different stripe is going to do something similar? And then, as you say, it'll be systematic, and that's a new rebalancing of the executive. I don't know. I mean, you might think that this is kind of a one-off, given that it's just a really different personality from what we've had. But, and you're right, there's been no incentive for anybody to push back personally. You know, it's just like, this is, you know, classic collective action problem. Nobody's going to stick their neck out, whether it be in Congress. Well, Republicans in Congress, I should say, have no incentive to do so. Democrats have every incentive to do so, since they would campaign on that, of course. But,
institutionally, you know, not much leverage.
Right. Yeah. But in the corporate community, in universities, elsewhere, you know, we haven't seen anybody really sticking their neck out. If anything, we've seen the opposite, and we've seen corporate executives, you know, sort of playing ball as much as possible, since they have every incentive to do so. I don't blame any individual, because I understand what the calculation is, but that's just, yeah.
So Len, let's look at one of the other linkages then. Let's talk about the executive power in the courts. We're running out of time. So I do want to kind of leverage your knowledge of internal Supreme Court politics and, you know, the role, you know, the degree of penetration of politics on the court. How do we make sense of, I mean, you know, the narrative to me, just to lay it out there, and maybe you know more about this than I do, but the narrative is kind of, over a long period of time, through a combination of, you know, interest group activity, organization, strategy, you know, the court has been rendered more conservative, or, you know, pushed in an ideological direction, aided by just some luck of the draw, you know, when Trump went, who gets more appointments, et cetera. But I would ask the same question about that check and balance relationship vis-a-vis the other branches that I asked about Congress.
Yeah.
Is, how do you read that? Are we looking at something permanent? What should the expectations be? Clearly, we're seeing, I think, unambiguously a series of decisions that show that this more muscular version of the executive has penetrated the Supreme Court. Certainly, the Chief Justice always felt that way. Mm-hmm. He seems to have a fairly good working majority on that. And we know that, you know, as this court has illustrated as well as anything, courts do some things and then they do change directions at times, albeit my impression is fairly slowly. So how do you read, again, the kind of impact on our accepted versions of separation of powers, checks and balances, when you look at the trajectory of the relationship between the court and the executive right now?
Yeah. Well, it's true. I mean, you threw a few simple twists of fate, which I think, remind us that the appointments to the judiciary, in particular the Supreme Court, really depend on, who happens to win the election by a really slim majority. And then I think Obama got really unlucky with, not unlucky, but it was unfair that the Merrick Garland appointment they played out the clock on that and didn't allow that. So that actually had pretty big consequence in terms of the numbers are so small that any single, move really matters, and that really mattered. And I think we've been, seeing this. I don't think the court and the rest of the judicial branch has been aggressively obliging of the Trump presidency so much as like little cuts here and there have added up to a lot, I think. And then if you look at some of the cases, I think the Trump v. U.S. Is one that is most interesting to me, and that's the immunity case, as you know, Jim. And that was, in retrospect, at the time, I didn't think of it as a huge deal, but now I'm thinking of it as bigger and bigger. I mean, the fact that now, Trump is so focused on prosecution and the threat of prosecution and, of course, previous prosecution. And if that decision, which essentially grants immunity for official acts, now that that's in place, you wonder if that is completely unleashed Trump. I mean, it's kind of overdetermined because, he was interested in doing more, from his great first term, knew how to do more, and now has the political balance. So he has every, but the immunity thing is huge. And if I could talk a little bit more about that comparatively, it's really different because, I mean, there are a lot of constitutions that give presidential immunity or head of state unity and head of government unity or immunity, like while they're in power. Right. And that's common because you don't want a president to be harassed, by all these lawsuits. But there's very few, I think there are about five or six that give immunity for them for official acts after they leave. Pretty much every
kind of a lifetime get out of jail free.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's only, it's Italy that has senator for life, and there are a couple others that come with immunity. Putin has it. But there's just not they're not very many. And the fact that the Supreme Court added that, and it's interesting, if you look at the argumentation, some people were on the court were kind of like, immunity might make sense if we want to encourage and incentivize the president to leave office. And of course, this had its real.
Right. You're already kind of starting at a deficit there.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But I mean, I think that I like that argument because in a lot of places where presidents don't leave office, promising immunity is a nice way to coax them out. And I think we need alternation. That's the most important thing in democracy. So I kind of like that argument. I think in the U.S., though, I mean, it's just, we've had a really pretty good tradition of people leaving office.
But it's yet another one of those questions where like, okay, so still operative?
Right.
And so let me close on that because maybe close on that. But I want to step back then, and that's a perfect setup for where I kind of wanted to go, which is, you've talked a lot about the constitutional order. And even as you're talking, you're careful in how you think about things. So I'm going to invite you to be a little less careful maybe, but this is an interesting subset discussion of this broader discussion that's now been going on for, really a decade or so since Trump's rise, ultimately, and since he surprisingly to some people won the election. And that is, How does this discussion fit into the broader discussion, and you can put on your Center for Law and Democracy hat now, about the trajectory of, you know, the overall process of democracy? And you know, in some ways, that's a little bit of an academic distinction, but I don't think so. You know, big conversation in the last decade, it's kind of ebbed and flowed about how, about democratic stress, mm-hmm. about democratic stress in the U.S. and what the U.S. case looks like. You know, thinking a little bit about, you know, our colleague Kurt Whalen's book last year and some stuff he's written. I did an event, a panel or something with Kurt for the college mm-hmm. a few months ago. And Kurt's argument, and I, you know, Kurt, I wish Kurt was here in a way, I mean, because I don't want to oversimplify his argument, but kind of like, but there's kind of a sense in Kurt's of like, if you look at this comparatively, the same way that you looked at Constitution comparatively, he's kind of like, you know, chill out a little bit. To mm-hmm. summarize, like, you know, there are some issues here, the things going on, but the idea that somehow we're undergoing a real democratic collapse in the United States, the constitutional order seems to be fairly durable. You know, his empirical work suggests that these democratic, one of the major democratic stressors is when the leader is over too, almost too popular, to your point about incentives and leadership. And with that, I'm not saying, hey, is Kurt right or wrong, but how do you, I mean, how does your entry into that yeah. make you view those discussions about democratic stress and, you know, how worried we should be, to put it colloquially, yeah. in the United States?
I used to agree more with Kurt. Kurt's been making this argument for a while. I used to agree more with him in the early days than I do now. And now I think it holds less water, although I think he's right that, you know, for the most part, the dam hasn't broken. But recently, you know, I've been looking at data on democratic backsliding across the world, and just trying to get a sense of really, are we in a recession?
Democratic recession.
Yeah. And there's so much great data out there now. Like, so John Gehring and his colleagues on the VDEM project, who you should have on, you know, have measured every aspect of democracy for the last 200 years. And, you know, I've been looking at those data and just plotting them and just seeing that, you know, at this point, in terms of both the depth and the duration of this counterwave, you know, we have these, as you know, Jim, these three waves of democracy worldwide, and almost like clockwork, every single democratic wave comes with a counterwave, you know, because there are all these tensions in democracy, and people realize, you know, it's not as great as they thought, but it is probably the best game in town. But there are always, there's some pushback, and, you know, and the counterwave, the counterwaves that occurred, you know, after the 19th century, after the 20th century, sorry, after the 19th century and the beginning of the 2000s, and then again in the interwar years, and then after in the 60s, none of those.
The beginning of the 1900s, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. none of these are as deep or as prolonged as our current recession, if you look at the data. So I guess, you know, I'm worried about the United States, but I'm also realizing that, you know, it's a beacon. And, you know, we always think back to, you know, President Reagan's, you know, shining
city on the hill.
City on the hill, right. Yeah, yeah. As a beacon. And if we're still the shining city on the hill, and a lot of it was about accepting immigrants and being this kind of, you know, the whole American mythology. But, you know, we're not that anymore. And that's might be troubling for us, but it's also more troubling for the rest of the world, since we are that beacon. And I think this has unleashed and incentivized a lot of non-democracy across the world. And I think that's picking, it's, you know, it's if anything, just picking up steam, even in places like the UK and in Western Europe. So I think, you know, given that kind of diffusion and interdependence across the world, I think it is actually more concerning than Kurt lets on.
Well, and I would say, again, to be fair to Kurt, I mean, I think he was probably assembling that argument really last year. And it's been a pretty eventful first 9 months, 10 months of the Trump presidency, seems to me. I mean, I've been wanting to kind of check in with I'll do that, you know.
And kind of say, well, you know, but you should check in with him.
It's getting a little harder. It's getting a little harder to be optimistic. Yeah. And, you know, one could, you know, scholars are good. You know, Kurt's a good scholar. He'll make the argument, you know. But I would say, okay, if we check in on your dimensions, how are all those dimensions looking? You know, I think we did this panel 6 months ago. And been kind of an eventful 6 months in terms of how institutions are functioning and all this constitutional, all this, these issues we've been talking about today, seems to me.
Yeah, you should check in and see if he's updated. Because I think that's one of the virtues is that you can go back, on your podcast, see what people have written, you know, theories they've held, and actually say, hey, how's that working out for you? And I, you know, like you did that with me, and I think Kurt would be a nice case for that as well. Yeah.
Well, look, what have we left out? Anything else you want to give you a point of, like, you know, I mean, there was a lot of things we could have covered that we didn't quite. But.
Yeah, I'm going to leave you with a fact, because I've been so focused on immunity these days and looking across. I collected all these data on prosecution of presidents across Latin America for the last 50 years, actually, and I've determined that 40% of Latin American presidents have been prosecuted. In some places like Peru, every single president since 1980 has been prosecuted, with one exception, and that person was only there as an interim president for, like, you know, less than a year. But, you know, that together with this problem of alternation power, people not leaving office, I think reminds me, and like this is one of my big things these days, is trying to build constitutions that have a graceful exit process for the president. And I think we need to think about that for Trump. I think we need to think about that for every single president, is how can they be ushered out, with dignity and with some privileges, actually, so that we can have peaceful transfers of power.
But without, presumably without completely sacrificing some degree of accountability.
Yeah. No, that's true. I think, I mean, a lot of these immunity clauses.
I guess
clauses,
I'm raising my eyebrows, right?
Yeah. I mean, these immunity clauses.
But I mean, I guess
clauses,
that's the nub. That's the rub, right?
I think that's exactly right. Is, okay, what's an official act? What's not? What's treason and what's not? Because I think the treason is the one thing that, even if you give immunity to a president,
that's a little bit,
you can't waive that. Yeah.
Well, and I'm reminded of, you know, to go back to my days as a Latin Americanist, of how, you know, the old saw among people that observed Mexican politics was, you know, the reason you gave Mexican presidents, and this sounds culturally insensitive, but I heard this from people in Mexico that, you know, and it was semi-joking, but there's a rub to it, which is, you know, you give people one long 6-year term, you give them time to steal as much as they can, but then it's over.
Yeah. And I thought this is where you're going with it. Give them the ability to select their successor.
Yeah, right.
The Dedazo, which, I don't know, that in terms of prosecution, maintaining the legacy and maintaining
that
recognition.
That kind of gets you what you're talking about. That also helps with that a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. That's like the one place where there have been, you know, almost, I think, without failure since 1917, as you know, like, you know, no problem whatsoever with presidential succession.
Yeah, people kind of worry about it kind of for a long time. Anyway, people kind of worried about it, and but it's, you know, they've hung in there.
Yeah.
Zach, this has
good
been
way to put it. Yeah, I like that.
This has been fun. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Really appreciate you coming.
Really great to see you, Jim. Thanks.
All right. Thanks to Zach Elkins. Thanks to our crew here in the audio studio in the Liberal Arts Development Lab at UT Austin. You guys are terrific. We appreciate you. Thanks to all of you for listening. You know, I'll post some of Zach's websites and some links to some of his work on our website at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. If you made it this far, probably, unless the wheels really come off the cart, new polling data next week. So come back and listen, and we'll be back next week with another Second Reading Podcast. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.